Welcome to the John, Paul, and Mike Show. I'm Paul Holmes.
And I'm John Jurisic.
You know, one day I'm going to say that I'm John Jurisic and just see how you react.
Well, considering that I have a cold this week, Paul, and my voice probably doesn't sound anything like your absolutely stunning radio voice, I don't think anyone would know the difference.
Yeah. Yeah, I could. Heck, if you're away one week, I'll just do both.
That's fantastic.
So what do we got on the show this week, Johnny?
Well, there is no end of topics for us to cover, especially on the political side.
Yeah.
There is this teacher strike, everyone seems to be talking about.
I didn't know. Tell me about. No.
There was a regional issue around sewage and CRD.
Yep.
That's really exploded in the last couple of days. There was a Liberal convention, a BC Liberal convention.
BC Liberal, yeah.
Over the weekend.
Yeah.
And with any luck, we might get somebody to speak to that.
Yeah.
Later on in the show. But I think today we're going to just start off with our week in politics.
Yeah.
And let's start off with this teacher strike.
Yeah. I know you have a lot you want to say about that, right?
It's interesting. You know, I ran an online learning company for a dozen years.
Yeah.
And we interacted directly with what I'll call the education industry in British Columbia. And it was a challenging, it was a frustrating,
and difficult process. Did you deal with the K to 12 range, or were you dealing?
That was who we were. Oh, that was our product for K to 12.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, okay. All K to 12.
Wow.
So we had some interactions with BCTF, but I think that we set the stage properly. Why don't we just identify for our listeners how many kids we have in school, whether they've been in school? I have four. They've all left. My kids went to school in the 90s.
Did they graduate?
They all graduated, and they've all done extremely well.
Congratulations.
But, of course, I'm a lot older than you are. And you have a younger child in the system right now.
I do, and he is eight.
Tell me how you've been vocal about this strike.
Yeah.
On social media, on TV. Tell me some of your thoughts. Give us your summary of where this is going, where it's landed, how you're feeling as a parent of a child in the K-12 system in BC.
Yeah, I think I can sum it up in one word, John. Frustrated. Frustrated. It's
Paul, everyone's frustrated with this, aren't they?
I don't know anyone who is. Well, the people who aren't are the people who don't have kids and don't care. But so there are some people that aren't.
I don't think anyone like that exists.
I ran into one person. They're like, I don't have kids. I don't plan on having kids. I don't really care. Maybe peripherally as a taxpayer.
There's a school tax in their property tax.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where to start on this thing?
Yeah.
Tell us what you
think. Well, you know, I've been railing for years, not just recently, but for years, on this notion that we need to modernize. We need to modernize our education system. Education in the it's almost cliche to say now, but it's still true. We have a 19th century school model. We herd kids together for the Industrial Revolution, and meanwhile we've moved forward in time to the 21st century. And so the question that needs to be asked is this entire model even one that's really appropriate for our society in the first place? And if it's not, and I don't think it is, how do we get from point A to point B and have a school system that's churning out the people for the economy of the future and the people for the world of the future and the scientists and, you know, all the important, you know, things that are happening? Because I'll tell you, I don't see it happening through this existing public school system. So.
Well, certainly there are efforts and there are attempts.
Yeah.
It's slow to change.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that.
For sure.
There are existing educational infrastructures that are embedded in our society.
Yeah. It strikes me that the problem is that the very people, the very organizations that would be having these conversations would be the BCTF, representing the teachers, the employers, government, minister, you know, maybe some blue ribbon panels, you know, things like that, right? The problem is we're in the state of militancy that's been ongoing now for probably approaching 30 years. How, you know, and so if you're going to sit down and have a collaborative planning meeting with somebody, you should bring a pen and paper or an iPad, right? You shouldn't bring knives and guns, right? That's the problem, is we've got these organizations who hate each other so much and just right down to the very core, and mistrust and just absolute disdain. How are those people supposed to collaborate and work together for a system for the future?
I think that's a great place to start, and some insightful reflection on the problem here. That until those two folks can start somehow having any discussion, some would call it mature adult discussion.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems we can't get forward to chatting about what might or might not need to change.
Yeah.
To adapt our, okay, Paul, I'm going to put you on the spot because you know that I always do.
Yeah.
And it makes for good radio. Oh, sorry, podcasting.
Podcasting.
What do we do? What becomes the perfect scenario? You've sort of stated it.
Yeah.
How do we get there?
Honestly, short of tearing down the entire system and rebuilding it, which I wouldn't be opposed to, the problem is that every change would be a radical one, and people recognize that, and people don't like radical change, right? But if you have a system that's so, you know, full of inertia, if you will, you know, that it's just not ever going to improve. At some point, you know, if you got the patient in the coma in the bed for 20, 30, 40 years, at some point, you just need to pull the plug, right? You know what I mean? And so.
Well, I know what you mean, but I can't see that happening in our lifetime. So what are just some practical steps? There's been discussion at, you know, I've heard. Well, there has to be an arbitrator. There has to be
I don't think arbitration settles it, because arbitration will get us past it, but the underlying nastiness still exists. So the next time these people get together at a table, they're still going to hate each other, and they're going to remember the last time and the fact that they had to go to arbitration. The other problem with arbitration that's been pointed out is arbitrator doesn't look at the bottom line, which is how much is in this pot of money. Right, they're kind of there to settle this
just
to settle it, yeah. And so at the end of the day, it's within the government's mandate to have a balanced budget and so forth and so on. If an arbitrator comes along and completely destroys that because they've, you know, spent too much money in the settlement of their arbitration, then the government has. I guess a mandate, if you will, to say, well, hold on a second here, right? And then we're no further ahead anyway. So I don't think arbitration necessarily settles it anyway.
Well, I've heard in the last little while, at least the premier indicate, oh boy, wouldn't it be great if they could just go into a room and shut the door?
Yeah.
Okay, really. Let's really get in the nub of this. How does this
I think they should have, like, electronic scanners they have to go through before they go into those rooms. Make sure that they, you know, they don't have any, maybe get airport security there.
Like, I don't know how this is going to change. I mean, let's be radical about this. I mean, is there different types of union or no union? I mean, how does this work?
Well, and one of the ideas that I came up with, and I'm certainly no expert when it comes to labor laws and negotiation stuff, but I am an interested party when it comes to history. And there's been many times throughout history where unions that represent large groups of workers get replaced. They throw out the old union and they bring in the new union. And you know, when we have situations where, just as a worker in XYZ industry, if I came to the conclusion that my union wasn't representing my interests, then I would want to vote to replace that union. Similarly, you know, I mean, if you think of it in a strictly commercial sense, what are you hiring the union to do? Well, you're hiring the union to negotiate on your behalf and to help you reach your goals, which are obviously your career goals and your salary goals, but also your workplace environment, but also presumably people who become teachers are interested in building a better education system because they care about kids. They wouldn't be in that business if they didn't start from that point. And so what they have now is they have the BCTF, which has this long track record of not settling anything. And so at some point, the teachers need to have a hard look at that and say, is this really serving our purposes?
Do you actually think that there's a teacher out there that thinks that?
I think there are. I think there's a lot. And I don't think it's a majority, but there's
clearly they're silent. I mean, they wouldn't
be. Well, they are silent because they're silenced, right? They don't have a voice because if they speak up, then their militarized colleagues will come down on them.
Do you think that's happening?
Absolutely.
Do you know that's happening?
I know that is happening.
Well, yes. So my kids were in a BCK to 12 from literally the mid 80s, late 80s till almost early 2000s.
Yeah.
Sorry, maybe mid 90s. And there wasn't an instance where there wasn't a teacher that wasn't trying their absolute level best to do the very best job they could do. Not one instance. So we really have to separate out this issue of the teacher and how well they're doing and how much they care for the child, and then the process by which they try to get better working conditions.
Yeah.
And that's the piece that you think there is some room for movement.
Yeah,
think there is.
Well,
how would they actually do that if they're being told and silenced?
Well, and this is part of the problem, and this is why I kind of raised the issue, because if teachers the government has their agenda. We're pretty clear about what that is. They obviously hate the BCTF and want to try to, lowball this and just move on and damage control. The agenda of the BCTF, though, I think is a different one, because if you've failed continuously at a job that you've been doing for years and years and years and years, you want to keep your job, right? Even though you're terrible at it, you still want to keep it because you want to get paid and you want to continue to do it. And so I kind of look at the BCTF, and a lot of what they're doing is, sort of riling up the teachers and getting them excited about really like setting up the government as a straw man, deflecting from their own incompetencies. And it's not to say I'm not a member of any political party provincially that has any power, but I certainly wouldn't say that the BC government isn't in part to blame for all this, not at all. But I also see the BCTF as being a big cog in the wheel that's not turning.
So Paul, a first step in the puzzle to fixing what I think collectively now everyone's coming to the same conclusion is a broken process.
Yeah.
Is to either have a new union or is that what I'm hearing from you?
Either replace the union with a new union or hire a different one. There are unions that, will go to the wall against the BC government, but will actually get things done at the end of the day.
So in the likely event that will never happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What then happens?
Pie in the sky.
So what's the next piece? Because really strategically and tactically from the BCTF position, they signed a one-year deal on the assumption that there'd be an NDP government.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That didn't happen.
Right.
And so we're back in this quagmire. So from their perspective, here we're saying, you're saying, have the, replace the union. Their perspective is replace the government.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So we're still stuck.
Yeah. And certainly people have obviously very vocally raised that, even on my Facebook. And I think that that's a potential way of dealing with it as well, would be to replace the government. The problem is the history of the BCTF has them at odds with every government. Social Credit, NDP, and BC Liberal governments have been at odds with the BCTF basically, you know, since the beginning.
Yeah, I know, but realistically,
I was in high school when these strikes were happening, and I'm an old man now. So
you're not so old. If you're old, I'm ancient. Well, I think that what I'm hearing from you, and likely what is starting to come from the general populace, is a desire to start to have rational, objective, unemotional discussion about this topic. That isn't happening, it appears, anywhere.
No. And it doesn't happen in the middle of these things.
So let's see if we can generate some of that dialogue on our show.
That's.
And so how would someone get a hold of us? We've got a bunch of social media tags and ways to do that. Let's hear some dialogue and let's really set a foundation, you and I.
Yeah.
Or a criteria.
Yeah.
Of rational.
Yeah.
Healthy.
Yeah.
Whatever that healthy means.
Yeah.
Unemotive dialogue on this issue.
Absolutely.
Boy, if we can find one person.
I want to hear some ideas.
Who can do that?
Yeah.
Let's do that, okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what are the taglines for getting a hold of John, Paul, and Mike?
Well, send us a tweet at John, Paul, and Mike, or on our Facebook, facebook.com/John, Paul, and Mike.
And they can listen to our previous podcast and reach us at johnpaulandmike.ca.
Yeah,
that's really cool.
And I would say definitely in terms of criteria, you know, I don't really want to hear people yelling and screaming about how evil the government is. I don't really want to hear people yelling and screaming about how evil the teachers are or greedy, because you hear that. I don't actually buy that. What I do want to hear is constructive ideas to build a better education system in this province and how we go from point A to point B, because I'd love to know what that is.
That's a great place to start. Let's see if we can find some folks who want to participate in that, because I would love to be part of that dialogue.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, that was a great dialogue, and hopefully we can find some grounds and some folks who might help us get out of that quagmire. Mm-hmm. Talking about a stinking quagmire. Yesterday, I know we don't like to date ourselves on our podcast, but sometime in May of this year, the provincial environment minister basically told the CRD that they're not going to get involved with the great sewage debate and that we have to solve this problem ourselves. Considering that that's literally impossible, although has bits and pieces of the previous discussion, here's another, the sewage debate, the lower Vancouver Island sewage debate, almost like the teachers' debate. How do we move forward?
How do
we get all of these folks to decide on a pathway forward?
Is it like the teachers' debate because it really stinks?
No. maybe we would say that unofficially. But it has elements of the same. It's been going on for a long time and not working.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, want to solve the problem, but don't know how to. And our current system doesn't allow us to. There would be folks jumping up and down going, amalgamate all the municipalities. That'll fix the problem. That won't happen.
Right.
That's another that won't happen.
I'd like to disagree with you on that, but that's a show.
Go ahead. Tell me.
That's a show for another. Talk to me
about your amalgamation discussion. I think it's relevant to this discussion.
It absolutely is. And anytime let's just take a real city somewhere with a population of about 350,000 people, and they want to build some infrastructure. They have a process to do that. They go through the process. They get it done. Here, you take the exact same objective. Suddenly, you have a stakeholders table that's filled to capacity because half the people or a quarter of the people don't even want to do it at all. Certainly, don't want to contribute any money, and don't see it as their problem. And it doesn't matter what the issue is. Sewage treatment is just the latest. Our fractured local government is is a cause of a lot of these problems. And, you know, like building anything in this town is like pulling teeth.
All right. So how do we move forward? Clearly, some of the leaders in this debate, Mayor Barb Desjardins from Esquimalt, it has got some apparently constructive steps moving forward, and that being smaller sewage solutions within municipalities or groups of municipalities that then would connect somehow.
Right.
But as with the teachers' debate, there is a core problem. We have a populace of somewhere in the neighborhood of 350,000 to 400,000 people that would put us in the second tier, I would suspect, of city sizes.
If we were actually a city and not just a group of municipalities.
Yeah.
At the moment, I think Saskatoon still beats out Saanich in population.
So we you know,
I have
sewage,
to a
police, water, recycling.
Yeah.
How do we get around this core amalgamation problem? There are folks trying to get the question onto the ballot in November.
Yeah, it's not
our working. Next. It's not working.
Yeah.
What can happen here, Paul? Is there something that you know? Like what's the province is not going to step in. If they're not going to step in on the sewage thing, they sure as hell ain't going to step in on this municipal amalgamation issue.
Yeah. Well, and it's yeah, I agree. I've been harping about amalgamation since I was 23 years old, which was a long time ago. And
you think that's where it's going to have to lie? That we're going to actually elect municipal politicians who want to amalgamate each other?
Probably. Yeah, I think that's probably the only way it's ever actually going to happen, and that would take a pretty huge concerted effort.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would literally be an amalgamation party.
Yeah, and try
with
to
a slate in every.
Well, and there's certain municipalities where. Those people just wouldn't win anyway. You know, they're just not interested. And I think I think some municipalities you could, that have been vocal opponents, Saanich being one of the key ones. It's hard to find a pro amalgamation person in Saanich because they have it great. They don't have to pay the big bucks of having a downtown, for policing and all the other costs related to that. Yet they still have their, you know, shopping centers where they can have the big tax base. So they've really got the best of both worlds in Saanich. Why on earth would they want to amalgamate with Victoria where it's all, everything's cost more and, you know, other than seeing the big picture being that as a region, we could really move things forward without stepping all over each other's toes. Would Saanich see a return on investment in amalgamation? In the short term? No, they wouldn't. They would see more, it would be more expensive. Over the long term, absolutely. I think the whole region benefits. But God forbid anybody have a long-term, you know, vision for the region.
I have not, and I'm likely representing the common person slash taxpayer out there. I have watched the sewage debate with some interest via our traditional media. Radio, TV, newspaper. I'm frustrated that we can't get to a place. It appears quite a bit of our money, taxpayer money, has been spent already.
Yes.
I heard yesterday somewhere around 50 mil, maybe another 50 mil just to move us forward.
Yeah.
Boy, I yet another massive issue that I'm just stuck. And you know me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm generally not stuck for words.
Yeah, and yeah, I really have no idea how this moves forward. There's still people who believe it shouldn't. You know, there's no problem pouring raw sewage into the strait. That the reality, of course, is that the federal government has mandated that. So we, you know, whether you believe it or not, it's been mandated. And so we have to
deal.
Well,
that's interesting. Yeah. Okay, so we got another big issue we could chat about.
Yeah.
That's stuck and stinks. So, Paul, another interesting event in this week in politics.
Yeah.
Was the BC Liberal Party had their first convention after the successful election from last year. I heard, even though I wasn't there and I'm not a member of the party, although I do help them try to get folks elected on Lower Vancouver Island, that it was a bunch of fun. It was a great party. And so, interesting, a year later after the election, Here we have liberals gleeful, literally gleeful. Their entire future depended on a successful implementation of an LNG industry, which to some degree seems not as certain as it might have been even 2 months ago, with Russia and China signing major agreements around moving LNG gas around their two countries. So what is the state of provincial politics from your perspective after a one-year anniversary of a totally unexpected victory? Mike Harcourt indicated within the last several days he's not yet ready to come back to the NDP fold. He had three criteria, one of them being a different leader or a charismatic leader. Yeah. I think they have that.
Sure.
However, they don't have a vision, according to him.
Yeah.
And secondly, they don't have, maybe more importantly, a vision to govern.
Right.
So, curious about your thoughts. Hopefully we can find somebody who attended that event and see what they thought about it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we know a handful between us. I think, I still hold that the BC Liberals didn't win the last provincial election. The NDP lost the last provincial election. And it's great.
It's a good point.
By default, they were the winners. And so good for them. And should they pat each other on the back? Sure. But I wouldn't get overly excited about the fact that everybody loves them, because I don't think a lot of people do. And I'm, you know, I haven't honestly read a whole lot of polls and stuff. They're the least bad option. That's kind of how I look at it.
That's interesting perspective. Of course, we're sitting in a region that has no Liberal candidates.
No.
No Liberal MLAs, at least until we get up island. There seems to be the rest of the province that has elected them and that might think differently.
Yeah, and I don't know. It's, because we live on an island, we live in a little bit in isolation. I think I even said on a previous podcast that I was astonished that the provincial BC Liberals did as well as they did, because, you know, I honestly thought the last provincial election was a slam dunk for the NDP. Obviously, so did the polls. So did a lot of pundits. They made a lot of strategic errors, the NDP on their part in running that campaign, though. So,
as a business person, private sector person, basically all my life, I will tend to fall onto the business party side. Mm-hmm. So let's just have that out in the open. Nonetheless, a little bit concerned that we have really one vision for the province.
Mm-hmm.
I'd feel more comfortable if there was not only an LNG strategy, but a strategy to diversify our economy, so that we're not exclusively resource-based. I would feel comfortable if we had, and arguably, and this could be for another show, or it maybe ties into our education discussion, that we are starting to mobilize our workforce and train our kids to adapt to a new world, a new world order. This podcast is getting interest, actually subscribers from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So when one thinks about an economy in BC, it's really an economy that fits in with the rest of the world. Are we prepared? I don't feel we are. I don't feel that we're focusing enough on diversifying our economy. And I've been saying this for 30 years.
Yeah.
Maybe it's pie in the sky. Maybe we are resource-based. End of story.
Well, and you know, it's a really good question, John, because I've been an entrepreneur all of my life, and I know lots of entrepreneurs. And it's a struggle to get by in any business. I read an article just yesterday in the Souk Voice News. I live out there in Souk. And it was about a consignment store that had closed their doors after some 9 years or 10 years in operation. And they interviewed the owner. And as I was reading the article, I was nodding along going, yeah. So, you know, why were you closing your doors? Well, you know, certainly competition, big box stores, everything else. People just not appreciating the fact that they needed to buy local was definitely one of it. But one of the things that the owner, raised that I thought was interesting was, you know, her the parents of the baby boomer generation, they could open a store and they could run that store and that could be their business. And they could do that not out of passion or because they needed a hobby, but to actually have a job that paid the bills and paid the mortgage and bought them a car and everything else. Our economy has changed so much, and it's not just a BC problem. I think it's happening around the world, that maybe this notion, this sort of quaint notion of running your own small business, is one that's a relic of the past.
Well, if you're not a welder or a carpenter or a pipe fitter or a laborer,
mm-hmm.
I would hope that we would be able to become excited about our future, and that there's an infrastructure about being excited about that future. And it's something that both you and I have talked to many people about, that where is the growth in an economy that's not resource based?
Yeah.
And where do regions that aren't directly impacted by resource based industry, like Lower Vancouver Island, to some degree, like the mainland, I wish that they would have chatted about that at the Liberal convention. I wasn't there. Mm-hmm. Maybe that happened.
Yeah.
And so once again, that becomes our third issue. So it seems like after we've chatted about this week's in politics, mm-hmm. we have three issues.
Yeah.
That we're going to talk more in depth about. One of them being state of education in BC and how does it move forward without killing each other.
Yeah.
How do issues on Lower Vancouver Island with, how many were there? 38 municipalities?
107.
107, yeah. Right. How do we move issues for ourselves forward within that quagmire?
Right.
And
take a national stage as well. You know, anytime, the cities of Canada get together, Victoria's, noticeably absent, at least noticeably to us.
And then thirdly, how do we start to engage a conversation in our province about economic development and the future of our economy
mm-hmm.
that isn't resource-based?
Well, and is there a future for small business owners in this province? Considering how many there are, if my small assessment of, a handful of people is bang on to what everyone else is feeling, how long can we continue to go in this new economy before things start getting ugly out there?
So it would then appear the fourth question becomes, what's the meaning of life?
Is that 47? What was it?
So we have a lot to chat about for now and for the future. Paul, once again, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you to the 12 listeners. Yeah. And one day we're going to trick them and have one of us try to represent both of us.
Yes.
All right.
Absolutely.
Have a great week.
You too.
And welcome to the show, Mike Gagan. Mike, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do, because it's a bit of a mystery.
I am, to use the pejorative, I am a lobbyist. In fact, my Twitter handle, which is now heading towards 11,000 followers, is @BCLobbyist, and what I do is I work with corporations, associations, First Nations in their dealings with government at all levels, be it federal, provincial, or local. I've even helped some companies in their dealings with First Nations as well.
So you don't sell cigarettes to children?
No.
That's what you do, Paul. So let's not bring that up, please.
Well, isn't that, I'm never one to judge, but what I will say is we've managed to have a pretty good policy of taking on clients where we're doing well by doing good.
Oh, that's good.
Oh, that's
good.
Really cool.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I've seen you, Michael, on or at least through social media, appearing on TV. You've appeared on major radio station programs. We're very lucky to have you and to hopefully build upon this week in politics, which Paul and I have just recorded, and talk to us about what's happened in your life this past week.
Well, myself and my associate, Ernie Robertson, who he's retired from it, but for a decade and a half, he was a counselor out in Colwood. We went up to Kelowna. We flew up to Kelowna, and we attended the BC Liberal Convention.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. So let's just agree that 95% of what really happened will not be talked about here. Because for us political types, there's some sense of what does happen.
Yeah.
But certainly a year after a shocking re-election, it did appear that there was almost like a party. At least that's how it was represented on the traditional media down here in Victoria. Tell us just some reflections on what it was like, and your some of the fun stuff that happened there.
Well, first of all, it was a fun convention. I have to say, it's probably one of the most celebratory and enjoyable political conventions I've ever attended or observed. In this particular case, I went as a delegate, but I have observed other conventions at both the federal and provincial level, and it was definitely a celebration and a genuine celebration. And for the reason you outlined, which is, you know, Christy Clark and her team came from behind 20-25% deficit in the polls and pulled off the upset victory so far, probably the greatest upset victory in Canadian history.
Yeah.
Anyway, in any event, there was lots to celebrate.
I just to play devil's advocate, Mike.
Why, because you're the devil, Paul?
I've been accused of worse, John.
We're recording later in the afternoon. It's going to get a bit testy here, I'm pretty sure.
I feel like the last two or three elections that the BC Liberals have quote-unquote won were not really as a result of people being excited about the BC Liberals, their leader, or their agenda, but rather that they've been scared to death of what the opposition would do. And so it strikes me that rather than be celebrating a victory that was handed to the BC Liberals, that they might actually become, you know, constructive in terms of coming up with good reasons for people to vote positively in favor of them as opposed to negatively opposed to the opposition party, primarily the NDP. Am I just being a crazy cynic here, or is there anything in what I'm saying?
Well, the element of truth to what you're saying is that, you know, when a political party, particularly a government, when polling is done, people can be expressing how the party stands versus their ideal. When it comes time to mark a ballot in the ballot box, it isn't the government versus your personal ideal. It's the government versus the opposition, or the party or parties that are most likely to be the alternative. And that can result in a very different outcome. The other thing that I think has really come home for political parties, and also for more particularly for polling companies, is that just because people indicate they're going to vote, doesn't mean they're going to, and that's increasingly showing up amongst younger voters, voters in their 20s and 30s. The percentage of people in that group that vote versus people who are in their 50s and 60s. So if you're a political party where older people are overwhelmingly in favor of you and younger people are overwhelmingly opposed to you, you're going to be winning the election, at least in the short run. What you obviously have to keep your eye on is, as those people get older, whatever the percentage then becomes of those people that are voting, making sure that you're winning that majority.
Right.
And the other thing I would say is that, you know, the pollsters all got it wrong. The pundits all got it wrong. As John stated, I did a couple of years when I was on CKNW. I did umpteen dozen or more years when I was on CFAX radio here in Victoria. And I still do regular appearances on CTV News Channel. But, you know, throughout the campaign, we were all working under the assumption that there was going to be an NDP government. And after the infamous Kinder surprise, I did in my commentary say that this is going to throw a spotlight on, you know, resource sector jobs versus protection of the environment, and it could result in a gain for the Liberals, and there's an outside chance of a come from behind Liberal victory, but that it was still looking unlikely. Well, it was more than a come from behind. In fact, Christy Clark ended up with a larger mandate than Gordon Campbell had in his last term.
Now, I've been both Paul and I, all three of us are very active on social media, and especially on hashtag BC Poly, and of course Keith Baldry, the BC TV reporter, is one of, I think he's got one of the largest followings as a pundit, as a reporter on Twitter.
Mike's catching up though.
Who is Mike? Is
Mike is
excellent. He sort of mentioned, I believe, in the first couple of days that he was up there, and I think he was up there, that they were still eating crow, these pundits, etc. Did you sense that at the beginning, that there was still a bit of, hey, you guys really got this wrong?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And when they played a summary video of the election campaign, I mean, it was a rather amusing montage of clips from Keith Baldry and Vaughn Palmer and others. They didn't use any of mine, thank you. Where, you know, people are predicting an NDP win, and then of course election night, when, you know, there was the look of shock and surprise, and then oh my goodness, like some of the pictures that they still frames they took from some of the reactions, of course, of the people that were at the NDP rally.
I'll never forget the one here locally with Lana Popham, Rob Fleming, John Horgan, etc. I mean, it genuinely looked like someone had died. But give us a sense. Therefore, should anyone ever listen to any of the polling coming out of anywhere? We now have an election out of Ontario, and I'm hearing already conflicting polling results happening there. Was that talked about, Mike? Is in the back rooms of all?
Well, I think what it's done is it's the days of easy polling are over. I mean, we have all remembered the infamous headline, the photograph where Harry Truman holds up a newspaper, Dewey wins.
And
in that instance, you know, that was referring to a presidential election back in the 1940s, just after the end of World War II, you know, polling had been done and phoning different people. And back in those days in the United States, there was still a significant number of households that did not have a phone. So, yeah, out of people who had phones, a majority of them were voting Republican. But that's not the same, you know, in terms of the people who are going to vote. Now we're in the situation where, you know, the number of people who have landlines versus the number of people who have who only have cell phones versus the number of people who have a voting preference but aren't going to bother to vote. I mean, it's meant that polling companies have a much more challenging time in having to sift through the data and not only determine what the preferences are, but what the likelihoods are of people from a certain group or demographic actually going out and voting.
That's just nuts. That's so many variables.
It has become maybe Paul or John, you recall the name of the guy in the movie Moneyball?
Yeah.
That guy. I mean, he seems to have come up with the formula to certainly predict the outcome of U.S. presidential races. I know, for example, we've got an election coming up in Britain, and they've thrown down the gauntlet and said, okay, we'll try and predict the outcome of next election in Britain, and he's refused because I guess there's too many variables in that.
Right.
Wow. I it's interesting just on polling, Mike. You know, I mean, we're in our early 40s, late 30s in this household, and
late 20s for me.
Yeah, and.
I haven't had a
landline forever.
Yeah.
The only people I know who have landlines are really, really old. And so,
hey,
is that you, John?
Landline.
Do you have a landline, John?
Yeah, I have a landline.
All right, there you go.
I'm 48 years old, and I have a landline.
Well, you know, there's exceptions to the rule, too, right? Because you undoubtedly talk a lot on the phone all day. yes. as part of your job, right? And so that having a cell phone 9 to 5 without an unlimited plan or something would be crazy for somebody like you. But for the average household, like, really, what do you need a phone for? Come on. And, you know, short of a home office, which actually, John, applies to you too. So, and people just don't use their phones as much. I mean, phone anybody under 30, and they're going to be like, why are you phoning me? Why didn't you just send a text? What the hell's wrong with you? You know what I mean? Like, it's a bizarre world, and I hadn't really thought about it in terms of what you were talking about, Mike, with the transition where only the wealthy people had phones, around the time of, after World War II. And now it's kind of, you know, only the older people, have landlines. Obviously, polling companies are looking beyond landlines, though, and have been for years. They're just trying to find their,
absolutely.
They're just trying to find their feet, right?
And also, it really came home that, you know, hey, if you weight equally the polling results you're getting from 40, 50, 6-year-olds and 20 and 30-year-olds, you're going to get an erroneous result.
Yeah.
And because if 20-year-olds are saying they're overwhelmingly going to vote NDP, but they're also overwhelmingly not going to bother to vote,
yeah.
then you have to discount the weight of that support. Just as, you know, if you've got people in their 50s and 60s and, you know, they're overwhelmingly supporting one party and the overwhelming number of them are going to vote, well, you have to add more weight to that result in terms of your overall conclusion in terms of who's ahead and who's behind. But it is a much more divining the tea leaves kind of process than what it was, say, 20 years ago.
Mike, I heard that there were quite a few newer members, since we're really now talking about younger folks and how they communicate with each other, etc. What was your sense of the kind of, like, I've been to social credit conventions, liberal conventions, conservative party conventions in the past. Sometimes, honestly, it's like going to an old folks home. And my sense is that was not the case up in Kelowna this time around.
Absolutely correct there. In fact, myself and Ernie Robertson, we got one of the larger suites at the Grand Hotel in Kelowna. So it was like a, you know, there's like two bedrooms and a living room and whatever. And so we got that room with the expectation of putting on a hospitality suite. And we had quite a number of young liberals in there. I mean, go figure, we were providing, you know, free food and beverages, including of the alcoholic kind. So,
gosh, there would have been young liberals too.
And so, you know, and when we say young liberals, I'm also talking about people like one of the you know, younger liberals had also run as a candidate, and, you know, in the last election for the Liberal Party. So we're not talking about, you know, like 14-year-olds. We're talking about people in their late teens and early 20s. And
yeah.
And yeah, there was quite a number of people there, as well as the old guard. But I got to say, I did not feel like one of the young people there, as I have in other situations.
Yeah.
I definitely was feeling like one of the middle-aged to older people there.
Okay. And how about in the sense that Christy Clark really represents a newer? She doesn't represent that Gordon Campbell party. Was this sort of the real threshold, the really breakthrough moment in which this is absolutely without a shadow of a doubt her party?
Absolutely.
Her delegates, yeah. her
yes.
vision, everything like that?
Absolutely. And like I say, I was honored to be a delegate to the convention, as was Ernie Robertson, because, you know, there was a great feeling of inclusion. And, you know, the other sense that I clearly got, you know, I was talking to one cabinet minister that I had dinner with, and that is there's far more the kind of approach that I like to see, where a premier is willing to delegate, is actually let cabinet ministers do their job and be in charge of their portfolios and not be micromanaging. And that was the thing that I found that I didn't like about the Gordon Campbell's style of doing things was the way, you know, everything was being run out of the premier's office. And Christy Clark, I think, from that sense, is a far more capable manager, because she's not a micromanager. She's a delegator, and I respect that, because that's my management style as well.
Mike, let's switch gears for a second. I think it's interesting now, with John Horgan, my MLA, winning by default the NDP leadership, and I've said on this show and in other places that it's perhaps the first time in
BC, certainly in a long, long time, that we've had two leaders of the major parties that you could say are charismatic leaders, and so that's changing the dynamic. I guess for me, and you know, I've never voted NDP. I graduated high school in 1990, and the economy was going down the toilet, and the NDP was, in government and messing with things, and I kind of never forgot that, and I'm old now, and so there's a lot of people certainly behind me that wouldn't necessarily paint that brush on the NDP, but for me, the only way I would ever remotely consider voting for the NDP would be if they radically modernized. To me, I think they're stuck in the 1960s us versus them kind of labor business, and as long as they continue with that, I think their prospects are not good. And so I have two concerns with that. The first one is we need to have an opposition that could theoretically govern, because I think that's healthy to a democracy, right? And the second one is eventually people will just get so fed up with the governing party, whatever they might continue to be called, I guess that we're sticking with BC Liberal for a while, that they're going to throw them out, and they're going to replace them with whoever is in opposition, regardless of the competency of that opposition, because, you know, it's just inertia. Eventually things change, right? And if the party that replaces this government is, you know, stuck in a 1962 labor mentality and owes 1,000 favors to all of their labor supporters, et cetera, I think we're sort of destined to see a repeat of the last time the NDP was in government. And I wonder if John Horgan is perhaps the man who can begin to modernize the NDP, or is he just the latest?
Well, I think if I was advising the NDP as to who they should have picked up as leader, I definitely would have said John Horgan, because he's the one who has, I would say, is closest to the political center out of the MLAs there. I think also when you're talking about the union movement, I draw a distinction between the private sector unions and the public sector unions. The private sector unions are not like the unions of the 1970s. They are far more pragmatic.
Yes.
They are far more reasonable.
Yes,
they understand that if their sector is not competitive, if their employers are not making a profit, that they're out of business or they're going to be replaced by a non-union firm. I've worked with Dale Dillon of the Plumbers and Pipefitters and Phil Benoit of the International Brotherhood of Election Workers. I got a lot of time for those guys because, for example, you know, they're about how can we bring jobs, how can we improve the training system and that sort of thing. So I see the private sector trade union movement as being far more proactive, and maybe it's because of, or at least ironically, even though they're far weaker now than what they were in their 70s, were in the 1970s than today. So I'm actually quite pleased with how the private sector unions have progressed, the majority of them. Where I shake my head is more with the public sector unions, and of course the most egregious example of that is being the BCTF. That's the one where, you know, do you not understand that, you know, when you're in a situation where your income and your benefits is significantly higher than the people that are paying the taxes that pay your salary, why that might not be a tenable situation? I know we're in a government town, but, you know, at a time when people who aren't fortunate enough to have, high-paying jobs, public sector jobs, I mean, they're really struggling to make ends meet, a lot of people. I think that's going to have to factor into wages and benefit packages for public sector employees.
Therefore, do you think John Horgan gets that?
Well, I think John Horgan is more comfortable with the private sector union guys. He's than the public sector union guys because I think he also understands, as the private sector union guys do, that whenever the public sector unions ask for more and get more, it means the amount that's being taxed off of the private sector. There's more going to be deducted from the private sector guy's paycheck, and they may not be able to make up for it in terms of their increases in wages.
So back to the convention for a moment.
Yes.
And tying into this concept that Christy Clark liberals likely got elected, not likely, they did. They got elected by the resource-based constituencies around this province.
Mm-hmm.
And so was there, at any point, was there any challenge, any discussion in the back rooms? Was there any moment when somebody said, is it too much risk to have all of our eggs in one basket in this LNG basket? And as I was talking to Paul earlier today on our, is there some diversity of risk? Can we not be looking at other industries and developing them in other parts of the province? Was that kind of discussion anywhere? And I would like to hope that it was.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I mean, I have a great relationship with Rich Coleman, and and I got an opportunity to speak with Rich at length, and it was mostly about stuff that was non-politically related, what's happening in his life, what's happening in my life, and that. But I mean, obviously, there's an awareness. China and Russia have signed a $400 billion deal. There's a recognition that we're going into a market where there is lots of competition, and yes, we have to be looking at being more competitive and also ensuring that today's young people are getting the education and skills they need for the job market that exists and also will exist. So one of the discussions I had with another politician, I won't name who, we had quite a discussion talking about how we had an education system that was basically set up or modeled on, the mentality of producing people who would be working, in factories, right? Like either on the shop floor or in the management offices or in the accounting offices or what have you. And that whole sort of factory model of the economy has largely gone by the wayside.
Yeah.
And so again, it's a really challenging time in terms of things. But I also, before I forget, I wanted to share a story since you talked about during the campaign. One of the stories that Christy Clark shared, we talk about the Kinder Surprise and how Adrian Dix, after the fact, we all quarterback it after the game, right? And how he blew the election. And I, for one,
hindsight is so perfect.
2020.
Yeah.
And I, for years, have always said, never underestimate the ability of the NDP to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. I've watched many provincial elections in this province where, going back to Dave Barrett, we don't need restraint. And boom, he went from leading in the polls to all of a sudden Bill Bennett was back and won that election. So,
yeah.
I mean,
I think the only time that happened the other way was that one time Gordon Campbell was supposed to win and Glenn Clark won the second term. Do you remember that?
Yeah, and that was also...
You were likely not born at that time.
Well, that was also likely... That was also... Yeah, there was also an inefficiency in the distribution of the vote in that you had the Liberals winning huge majorities in the North Shore and other ridings, and meanwhile the NDP was just squeaking in, so it ended up being, the Campbell won the popular vote, but the NDP won more seats because of more efficiency distribution of vote. But this story, it was interesting because I did not know this, and Christy told us that, is when Adrian Dix made that announcement that he was going to reject the Kinder Morgan pipeline, his polling numbers for the next 3 days still went up. They were still increasing.
Right.
So it wasn't the immediate death blow that we now all assume it was. And there was some discussion. I can tell you there was some discussion internally about, should the Liberals emulate that? And, I think that would have been a disaster. I think that would have ensured the collapse of the Liberal vote because, people would have been that were interested in resource sector jobs. I mean, they would have either stayed home or thrown their vote to the Conservatives or I don't know what. But Christy said, no, we're going to stick to our principles. And of course, the whole hard hat campaign strategy was absolutely brilliant it undercut a core constituency of the BCNDP, which is, the blue collar voter and
the private sector union guy.
Yeah. And one of the things that I've had in conversations with Christy over the years is, you know, I've reminded her about the fact that, you know, when the Reform Party first swept to prominence, you know, they went from one MP to a bunch of MPs, you know, in that election in BC, the NDP actually had a majority of the ridings in British Columbia at the federal level. They'd won a majority. Yeah. And the biggest chunk of that vote went Reform. The second biggest chunk went Liberal, and the third biggest chunk were the people that stayed with the NDP. So the NDP went from a majority of federal ridings to a small group, and then, of course, the Reform had the strong majority of ridings in BC. So there has always been a group of voters that are willing to switch, you know, between the NDP and you know, the Conservatives or the NDP and Reform. And we saw this play out in the election where there was a whole group of them which took a collective gasp and maybe it took a few days to sink in and went, yeah, you know what? I want to ensure that that we have jobs where, you know, me or my kids can actually afford to get a mortgage and raise a family, because that is the real challenge our society is facing. I call it the Whistlerification of British Columbia, and I've been using this line again for years. We're reaching a point where our children won't be able to afford to live in this province. It will be a world-class destination for the wealthy and wealthy retirees to come to, and there'll be people living in basement suites and renting wherever, you know, serving coffee and other service sector jobs.
That's already happening out in the peninsula here on Lower Vancouver Island. They can't live out here. It's a major, major problem.
Exactly. And like I say, I mean, it started in Whistler, and it's now all over Vancouver, and it's increasingly happening in Victoria. And one of the things that I think the NDP is blind to is that, you know, their policies regarding the Agricultural Land Commission and other things, you know, let's have everything nice and green and what have you. That's nice, but you're creating an ideal environment for the wealthy. You're not creating an ideal environment so that your kids can continue to live here.
It's an issue I'm dealing with the manufacturers out on the peninsula. In fact, some of our regional municipalities, it's not generally talked about publicly, but certainly behind closed doors, are really questioning their long-term sustainability. The school enrollments are down. Where's the rebirth? Where's the regeneration of people? Well, they're moving out to Souk and Langford and up Byron.
Well, and beyond, John.
Or Alberta. I mean,
exactly. The reality is, and I've been saying this as loud as I could to whatever politician would listen to me for a decade, housing affordability, general affordability, especially here on Vancouver Island, man, you know, like, the wealthiest people that I know in this region are the ones who moved here from somewhere else with their wealth. The average person who grew up in this region that I know, they're scraping by. It's no place to get ahead.
So Mike, you had all these young folks. You have a party re-energized. You have obviously there was a happy time.
Yes.
Vancouver Island is not part of that. Neither
yes.
is what they refer to as the Sunshine Coast. So what? You're a guy from Southern Vancouver Island. Was there any chatter about that at the convention?
Well, yes, yes, there was. I mean, I was. I mean, Rishi Sharma, who was a candidate in Saanich South, he was at the convention as a delegate. Interestingly enough, blast from the past, Judy Taiachi was there. Since you mentioned,
really?
Judy Taiachi was there.
And, wow.
And the biggest comment.
Was she an observer or a delegate?
She was a delegate.
Wow.
Because remember, Gordon Wilson came out during the last week or two of the campaign, came out and publicly endorsed Christy Clark.
Yes. And I do remember that.
And he got that position. And also, you know who hired Christy Clark to be a research officer at the legislature way back in the day? Gordon Wilson. And I know all these things because I've known Christy Clark since she and I were both 18 years old, and she was a student politician at SFU, and I was the VP finance of the Student Society at UVic. So,
well,
you know,
she looks a whole lot younger than you do.
Well, first of all, I would say good genes and good living.
hey, Mike, another thing I noticed wasn't covered in the media. I got to say, not a lot of the stuff has been covered in the media that I've noticed, But, you know, it's like this whole convention could have not happened, and I'm sure a lot of people would be none the wiser. But apparently there was 2 hours of policy discussion and debate.
Yeah.
On the Saturday. Is there, was there anything interesting out of that? Anything? And I guess here's a bigger question for you. Does any of it actually matter? Because the government can pretty much do what they want with those policy resolutions anyway, right?
Well, for example, I mean, the short answer is no, it doesn't. It doesn't matter because, I mean, the Liberals, unlike the NDP are the only party that even bother to still come up with a pretext like, oh, our membership sets policy, and then when we're elected government, the government's role is to enact that policy. That's an utter lie. That's utter nonsense. But the NDP, as part of their belief system, still trot that line out as to why they're different from all the other political parties, which, and having, you know, in terms of their conventions, that's why they have these lengthy and earnest policy debates. So whereas the Liberals know it's more like suggestions, right? So people don't get as heated, they don't get as worked up.
Interesting. Right on.
Yeah. So I remember one policy in terms of increasing the penalties for people texting while driving, and just to be a bit of a cheeky monkey and also to vent my frustration, you know, I brought up one of my favorite topics, which is, you know, and I said this at convention, we have some of the most dumbed down speed limits in North America. I mean, back in the, I don't know if you guys are fans of Mad Men, you know, the TV show, but back in the days of Don Draper, you know, the speed limit on the Pat Bay Highway was 70 miles an hour, which is 112 kilometers an hour. Today, for most of its length, it's 80 kilometers an hour, and we have some overpasses, and we have, instead of drum brakes and no seat belts, we've got seat belts and airbags and anti-lock braking systems and crumple zones and far safer, better handling vehicles, and the speed limit is significantly lower.
Are you suggesting that we should do away with the taxes that we would call speeding tickets then?
Well, yeah, and actually what had happened, I guess what kind of triggered this is there was some guy from who I assume was a delegate, but he was also made a point of mentioning that he worked at ICBC, and he went on this little sanctimonious tirade about people texting while driving, which again is insane to do, and they should be penalized. But the point is that, you know, I also had to take the shot at, you know, ICBC and government using ticketing as a cash cow, right? You know,
giving tickets
to people who have the temerity to go with the flow of traffic, which is actually the safest thing to do when you're in traffic, is go with the flow. If everyone's doing 100 kilometers an hour, go 100 kilometers an hour. Don't be going 80 kilometers an hour. You're much more likely to be in or cause an accident. And in fact, there's been several jurisdictions in the states where they, you know, because the original, like, lower the speed limits down to 55 was because of, you know, to reduce fuel consumption. And when they've raised them back up, they actually found the accident rate went down because people, it allowed people to drive at the natural speeds of those roads rather than people suddenly slowing down or doing whatever because they saw a police car or because they decided in their passive-aggressive way that it was their job to try and keep traffic to the speed limit.
Speaking of taxes that aren't called taxes,
yeah.
Anybody talking about the abhorrent blight that known as the MSP premium? Not that I have a strong opinion on that.
Well, actually, there was a policy. I don't have the policy book right in front of me, but one of the policies that was discussed was that there being a review of all the taxes and fees and whatnot that are being charged. And the one that was front and center in the discussion was, in fact, the MSP.
And
the fact that it's a regressive tax because...
Regressive and a middle-class killer.
It is a middle-class... Because, you know, you pay the same whether you're the working poor or whether you're a multimillionaire. It's like,
exactly.
Oh, you've got...
The only justification of that tax is to hide the fact that our provincial tax rates are actually much higher than they are so that we look good when people compare taxes across different provinces,
yeah.
Right? Like, and it's killing the sort of just squeaking through as middle-class people a good reason to, you know, for a PR campaign. Like, I don't think so.
No, and in fact, one of the delegates did talk about, and I think it was in Ontario, where they have the equivalent of an MSP, but it's prorated, so it's added on. So instead of paying it monthly, it's a once a year thing. But it again, it's part of your taxes,
yeah.
And it's prorated based on your income. So if you make a lot of money, you pay a lot more for it, and if you don't make a lot of money, you pay nothing or relatively little.
Well, I'm so glad to hear that because, you know, any time I've raised that issue with any provincial politician from any stripe, it's like, oh, well, there's, you know, if you make less money, you know, then there's subsidies and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, no, as soon as you hit the, whatever it is, $32,000 a year household income, which is basically in Victoria, flat broke all the time income, you're paying maximum.
I know. Like women working as LPNs or RCAs and what have you, and you know they're struggling to put food on the table for themselves and a child, and then along comes their medical service plan bill. And I have to say that MSP are much more aggressive than probably any government agency in terms of mercilessly hounding people for money.
Oh,
I think
yeah.
WCB
yeah.
is.
I'm hearing this secondhand, but the stories that I've heard, I mean, absolute horror shows. And you know, much more aggressive even than, you know, Revenue Canada when you owe them money.
Big time, yeah. No, you're absolutely correct. And I don't know why that is, but I've definitely heard that story. They're some of the most aggressive collection agency.
So, Paul and Mike, we could likely go on forever. And I really hope that we can get Mike for future this week in politics. Can you give us, as a way to tie up this session, maybe without naming names, without naming participants of any kind, something really fun or unique or very different that happened in Kelowna that you can share with our audience?
I have to say that the highlight my convention, the convention I attended, was that we went over to Prospera Place, and there was a whiskey bar, and it was hosted. There was also some winery, like people showcasing different wines,
right.
and on the screens, you know, they had some movies playing, like old black and white Western movies, like How the West Was Won and stuff, without the sound on, and they had a buffet table with different appetizers and roast beef. So it was basically free roast beef and free whiskey. So needless to say, I went to town, and they had a mechanical bull.
I'm drooling.
They had a mechanical bull set up, and there was a number of people, including cabinet ministers and others that took a ride on the mechanical bull. And I did not go on it, but I have to tell you, the next day, my head certainly felt like I'd gone on it because I felt like I'd been kicked in the head by that mechanical bull.
Well, on that extraordinarily pleasant note,
were there any cabinet ministers wearing bikinis while on the bowl, or any sort of gossip like that we can break election?
I don't think anyone wanted to be left with any lasting psychological scars, so all that was avoided.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you.
And, boy, I really hope we can get you on some future broadcasts.
Happy to be back whenever you want.
And Mike, what's the best way to find out more about your company and to reach out to you?
Go to my website at bclobbyist.com and follow me on Twitter at @bclobbyist. If anyone has an issue, shoot me an email or phone me, because both pieces of information are on my website.
That's excellent. Fantastic. Thank you.
Thanks.
Great stuff.
Thank
Bye
you.
Now.